This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another episode of the Tradition Podcast, coming to you in video format, courtesy of Zoom. I'm sitting remotely with my friend, Rabbi Professor Joshua Berman, professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan University, and author of the recently released Ani Ma'amin, Biblical Criticism, Historical Truth, and the 13 Principles of Faith from Magid Books. In Tradition's Winter 2020 issue, we published an excerpted chapter, The Truth Versus Historical Accuracy of Tanakh. And in our upcoming spring issue, we'll be publishing a review essay, which says, Berman's book is vital for understanding the relationship between faith and academic Bible study. Where we can benefit from these those texts as useful tools in learning and appreciate the staggering revolution of the Torah within its ancient context. Berman's book is an important contribution to scholarship and to our religious pursuit of truth in the context of Tanakh study. He challenges readers to examine critically the assumptions they bring to the text, provides a fresh perspective, and expands our horizon in learning, methodology, and religious growth. So that's high praise indeed, and welcome to the podcast, Josh Berman.
Thank you, Jeff, and we should also thank Rabbi Chaim Angel for composing those lines in that review.
Indeed, indeed. And it's a pleasure to speak in these very dark and troubling days of coronavirus. It's a pleasure to speak about something light and frivolous like the actual authenticity and divinity of the holy books. Only in right. Such bizarre times could we say something such as that. But it's a pleasure to cleanse our intellectual palates and discuss something else. At the same time, we hope, of course, that you and your family and all of our listeners are safe and healthy.
Amen.
The book, which examines these larger questions in biblical criticism and the questions of the authorship of the divine books, between the lines, is a very personal book. To a certain degree, one might even say there's a kind of spiritual intellectual autobiography going on here. So before we talk about the actual content of the book, tell us a little more about its genesis and about your long occupation with the topics that you write about here.
Yeah, so really, Jeff, it's true. The book is from my kishkas. It really is. I feel that way. It's taken up the last 10 years of my life. And it really starts, I would say, with my formation as a child, which was a little bit different than perhaps many of our listeners. It's kind of difficult to peg me. I'm somewhere between a BT, a Baal Tshuva, and an FFB, from birth, as they say, which is to say that my parents were not from observant backgrounds, but Baruch Hashem, following the aura of the Six-Day War, they had the good sense and desire to instill within me a strong Jewish education. So they sent me to Yeshiva Day School. I went to SAR Academy in Riverdale for elementary school. And then I, around the time of my bar mitzvah, I kind of took it all upon myself. I had great teachers and I was very much inspired. I start with all that because it means that as opposed to many people who I think have the great merit of being able to say that their commitment to Yiddishkeit is from their mother's milk. It isn't even something that they ever had to think. This is just the most natural thing for them. Yes, they can entertain questions. Maybe they even have some sfeikos, but on a very deep level, it's just deeply who they are and who they always were. Autobiographically, for me, that's not the case. And so always kind of looking at the Masorah from within and from without is just a natural mode for me. Now, these issues really didn't bother me at all until not such a long time ago, about 10 years ago. That would be like in my mid-40s, and it really can't, you know.
You were already teaching at Bar-Ilan University after we should say having had something of an early career in more traditional settings of Torah teaching.
Sure, yeah. After I finished getting smicha at Gush, I started doing the rounds in the sems, the seminaries, mm-hmm. Teaching Tanakh. That's what I was very much attracted to. And following basically the same type of overall approach one would find in the works of Rabbi Yoel Nun or Menachem Liebtag, you know, this beautiful literary stuff. And I was a happy camper, a totally happy camper. Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago, a colleague of mine at Bar-Ilan convened a kind of discussion group, mini think tank, if you will, of religious Zionist educators, rabbanim, scholars, to kind of roll up our sleeves and discuss what are we going to do about this issue of biblical criticism and how we as Orthodox Jews approach it, defend against it, incorporate it, or all of the above. And this is clearly something that arose out of just the exposure that we all have to the internet. You know, I think that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we, you know, these were questions that maybe in the tops of the ivory towers of Yeshiva University, maybe this was given some thought, but not very far out of there. But now with the internet, everybody is exposed, even from an early age. It's not just when you go off to college anymore. A lot of our high school kids are exposed. They already arrive at their year, their gap year, quite aware and having been exposed to quite a lot. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great. This discussion group, you know, which included some very serious people and very, very prominent names. And I thought, okay, you know, we're going to learn from each other and we're going to come up with stuff. And I have to say, I was rather scandalized at what I saw, because what I saw is that particularly among the mechanchim, they were there, rabbanim, people who maybe read a little bit, you know, in an avuncular way from the side, but not people who, you know, who are inside the university day in and day out, there was kind of a feeling of, well, since of course we are truthful people and the university tells us what is truth, so now we have to figure out how to bend the Masorah to kind of fit this truth that we're getting from the university. Mm-hmm. And I was just scandalized. I go to the conferences, I read the journals, and I don't think that all of that is so clearly the truth. So there's a lot of sides to it, and there's a lot of nuance, and there's a lot of alternatives. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took it upon myself. I want to find, really, to start for myself. Can I find better answers that are academically solid, that my colleagues who are not Orthodox and not Jewish will be able to say, yeah, those are very interesting insights, or those are very interesting critiques of the methodology. And if I can do that, then that needs to be part of our address as Orthodox Jews of this issue. That was 10 years ago, and now we have a book.
The book, the title, of course, begins in the transliterated Ani Ma'amin, I believe. It's a, as you said, it's something of a personal statement, which, as I said, between the lines of the text, we can intuit that there's a lot of Josh Berman going on here. It's not written in the manner of some of your earlier books that were published by academic presses, the authorial voice of the professor speaking from on high. In that regard, I say it's rather personal. But this question of belief and this question of the personal. Many readers and many people looking from outside would presume that there's something of a conflict here, that you have to balance different professional identities, different personal identities, different belief systems in your work as a believing academic. As you said, you go to the conferences, and many of these academic Bible conferences are not places that are populated from top to bottom by believers in revelation and the divinity of the text, quite the contrary. So how do you do that? How do you integrate these different aspects of your work and your life and your faith?
Right. So it's not just that I am proud of my orthodoxy and the fact that I'm a rabbi. I think that being orthodox and being a rabbi make me a better scholar, period. And I'll explain why that is. I think, and this is really a leitmotif throughout a lot of my work in my previous books and in this book too, which is that so many of the questions that come up from biblical criticism against traditional belief stem from very modern and very anachronistic ways of thinking about things that are very intuitive for modern people, all modern people, for modern scholars, for me, for you, for most of our listeners. And it's remarkable. This is my favorite thing about being an academic, is when we begin to discover that the things that are just so obvious to us, 2 + 2 = 4, and you begin to look in earlier times and see so many things that were thought about so differently. I'll just throw out, just as an example, you know, if you have a word in one culture and it's very central and you don't find that word in another culture, something's going on. There's a gap that needs to be explained. And I'll just share with you, Jeff, and with our listeners, several words that we would think are just so cardinal for the discussion of so many things that every culture must have a word for them. And what emerges is that words like religion, politics, history, fact, fiction, law, belief, not one of those words has a parallel word for it in biblical Hebrew or in rabbinic Hebrew. That is the language of Chazal, the language of the Talmud. And that's remarkable because we would think, wait a minute, I mean, obviously all these areas are covered in both in the Tanakh and in the Talmud, you know, going through that list again, fact, fiction, religion, politics, law, history. But none of those words exist. And therefore, all of these, this requires us to
be clear. To be clear, you have words like emet v'sheker, truth and falsehood. But conceptually, that's not the same as the modern notions of fact and fiction.
That's correct. That's correct. Right. That's correct. Right. And so much of this book is about kind of removing the layers of assumptions that we have just to be able to get back to see, well, how are they dealing with these things? And it's only because being Orthodox means that we have deep within us many pre-modern sensitivities that we bring with us. And so it's getting back in touch with those to help us make better critical sense of the Bible.
Yeah, this brings me to the chapter which was published in advance in our journal, which is open access on the website of traditiononline.org in our winter 2020 issue, The Truth Versus Historical Accuracy. So say a word about what you say there, because it really introduces the reader to perhaps the major theme of the first half of the book.
Okay, what I try to show there is that let's put aside Tanakh, let's put aside religion. When you look at the figures that are often called historians in pre-modern times, Herodotus or the Venerable Bede, what scholars of those figures have noted is that they're not quite doing the history that modern historians are doing. They're working with a whole range of assumptions about what types of material do you bring in? What is the purpose of what you're writing? What embellishments are you allowed? A whole set of assumptions about the author, about the audience, that are very different than modern historians. And the Torah is written in that vein as well. Hmm. And so it's just really important to understand all of those assumptions to be able to properly judge what the Torah is doing and why it's doing it.
Mm-hmm. And that leads the reader to understand that questions of historicity. Are the stories in the Bible history with a capital H, the way that we hold contemporary works of history to a certain standard of factuality, mm-hmm. is asking the wrong question entirely.
Yeah, and this is not apologetics. When people say, oh, the Torah, it's not a history book. But we want it to be a history book. We want it to be fully factual. This is a perfect example of imposing our modern sensitivities about things on pre-modern writings. Nobody wrote the way that they write, they supposedly write today, fully factual. Nobody did that, ever.
Right. You use the term the hortatory impulse in the biblical works. Mm-hmm. It's there to teach something. It's there to teach something about life, about morality, about virtue.
But Jeff, it's important for you to point out, this does not mean that it's all myth, and this does not mean that it's entirely divorced from reality. What I try to show is that there's always, this is true of all the writings that are called early histories, there's a core that is true, and then there's a degree of embellishment that is allowed and indeed encouraged so that the listener gets the inspiration that they need.
Right. Particularly in the book, you have a long section that you deal with the question of numbers, of census numbers, which might be difficult to square with what history and anthropology and archaeology tell us today. And part of what you're doing is resolving the conflict, right? Or what I'd like to say, you create a permission structure in which the existence of something which cannot be squared with scientific fact or archaeological fact or historical fact does not create a monkey wrench in the works of belief that causes us to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right, exactly.
Right. And that indeed is
or to throw the Bible out with the bathwater.
The Bible out with the bathwater. And that indeed is probably, you know, another major theme that runs throughout the work, both in the first section, which deals with these, you know, larger questions, perhaps the most important one of which is the chapter dedicated to the historicity of the Exodus, which has so many implications for not just for belief, but for religious life. After all, Orthodox Judaism is built on a body of lived religion, of ritual, of daily mitzvah, so much of which is connected to the historical memory of the Exodus, of having been slaves in Egypt and having been brought out of a house of bondage with an outstretched
hand. And that there was an Exodus.
And that there was an Exodus.
Was an Exodus.
Right. And so that's, I think, one of the accomplishments of the book. In the second half of the book, the part that deals principally with Maimonides' 13 principles, or Rambam, as you're careful to call him in the book, speaking to the home team, speaking internally to a religious community. Rambam's 13 principles of faith, the eighth principle, which has to do with belief in the divine authorship of the Torah as dictated to Moshe from God on high. So maybe say a word about what you're doing there in the second half of the book.
Right. So as Orthodox Jews, we affirm our commitment to the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam. What I want to do in this second half of the book is to say, because that is the case, we have to really invest in our understanding of this whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. For example, which text of the 13 Ikarim have we accepted? Have we accepted the Ikarim as they appear in the introduction of the Rambam to Perek Chelek in his Perush HaMishnah? Are we accepting the Ikarim as they appear in the Mishnah Torah? Are we accepting the Ikarim as they appear in the Ani Ma'amin, who is, we don't know who wrote that, in the back of our Ashkenazi Siddur, or the version in our Sephardi Siddur, which are different? Or is there perhaps no one authoritative text, which you'd be surprised? Well, once you read the book, you'll understand. Mm-hmm. There are many, many Gdolei Yisrael who felt that way. So that's one set of questions. Mm-hmm. Another set of questions.
Not just Gdolei Yisrael, but it's other Rishonim as well.
Right. But yeah, in other words, what I'm saying is that not only you have Rishonim who didn't accept the Rambam, that people know. What I'm telling you is that you have Achronim, who deliberately say we must leave open the definition of each of these Ikarim for each person or each Gadol to define as they wish. And perhaps even a greater question that I try to pursue here is, we have accepted the Ikarei Emunah. What has that meant historically? What has acceptance meant? And this remarkably, and I trace this through from the Middle Ages to the 20th century, this has meant different things at different times. And why that acceptance has changed is totally fascinating. And how is this acceptance similar and or dissimilar to our acceptance of halacha? These are all fascinating questions. And if we are truly committed, as we must be, to accepting the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah, then we must delve deeply into these questions. That's the second part of the book.
And there are of course multiple aspects here. One is the binding nature of different principles of faith, and that kind of sense of permission structure that a person who cannot or cannot yet fully embrace the Rambam's definition of divine authorship, yeshal malasmoch. There are other opinions within our tradition which creates a kind of an environment in where a person feels, if I cannot fit ideologically 100% squarely in one belief system, that doesn't mean that I'm out of the picture. And then as well, the notion that there are different ways of viewing these topics, and to remain an insider without feeling that we need read such people out of the community creates room for the educational moment to happen. It's not necessarily all or nothing as we often tend to think.
Right. With the caveat that, you know, for the last 200 years, all major authorities have affirmed that we have accepted the Rambam's Ikare Emunah. But I think that we need to look at what that acceptance means.
And of course, these topics have been dealt with recently by Mark Shapiro and Menachem Kellner and others. And you build on that, literature in the context of what you're trying to do in this particular book.
Right. I would say a lot of what I did is deeply indebted to those works that you just mentioned, Jeff. I would say the thing that I add that I did not see discussed there, but which I think is absolutely central, is what does acceptance mean? What has it meant? And how has it changed over time and why? And this is what I discuss in the book.
Now, this question that I mentioned a moment ago about the book really being a kind of internal document. This is speaking principally to the modern Orthodox community, although you and your publisher would be happy for others to buy and read the book. But interestingly,
there were others on both sides.
Yes. Well, recently you published a charming essay where you talk about a secret Zoom meeting, which may not have been recorded and made available like this is, with a group of Satmar Hasidim in Williamsburg. And on the other hand, you also have been engaged in conversation with Christian colleagues who are also involved in academic Bible study, but face in their own way, in their own theological traditions, similar challenges to our own. So say something about those different outings to other communities.
The outings into the Christian world for me have been absolutely fundamental for my own personal growth and for what's been produced here in this book, and I'll explain why. All of us know in our community, Jeff, that this whole foray into the world of the academy at all, liberal arts particularly, Jewish studies even more, and biblical studies is fraught. That anybody who's doing this is basically biting the apple of Gan Eden and you know, consuming the forbidden fruit. All of us have that sense in one form or another. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any exaggeration in that, okay? So we do it because we feel that there's a need to somehow confront what seem to be some true claims, some serious questions, but it's fraught religiously and emotionally. When you look at Christians who are deep believers, who believe like we do that the Bible is divine in origin, who believe like we do that the events told are essentially true events, who believe like we do that the Torah must cohere together and is not a cobbled together patchwork of sources by competing schools in ancient Israel. But you see these people and they embrace this type of challenge of looking at the critical questions and finding alternatives. It comes so naturally to them. They revel in doing it. And the reason is because for Christianity, theological growth and university studies have always been married to one another. It's not like with us, you know, where we were in ghettos, either physical ghettos or ghettos of our own making, you know, the walls of the base medrash.
Ghettos of the mind.
Yeah, and of the soul. And, you know, so having the two people as you and I should have this such a discussion would not have happened 30 years ago, for sure. This is all new for us. And so for me to meet men and women of deep faith who also engage the critical stuff and are comfortable doing it has been such a source of chizuk for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there's, in some ways, more at stake or different matters in the balance, since so much of, you know, conventional biblical criticism plays into not just questions of the authorship of the book, but halachic practice. And that has traditionally made even open-minded Orthodox thinkers and writers and scholars more cautious about engaging in these topics?
I think that there is, you see a trend of online of people, there tends to be affinity between people who are overall pushing for a greater liberalization of halacha, tend to be those who embrace more of these critical questions and more of these critical findings, which makes it all the more fraught for us. Absolutely.
Right. Do you, in your interactions with Christian scholars, Do you look back at our own community and our own traditions of reading and interpreting text? Are you at all concerned that there's been a kind of development in Jewish, I wouldn't say interpretation of the Bible, but Jewish engagement with the Bible, which has something fundamentalist about it? Because after all, the Jewish tradition of biblical interpretation was always grounded on the Midrashic imagination, which both Midrash Agadah, but Midrash Halacha as well, which said we cannot take the written text at face value. It always has to involve an oral interpretation and ongoing exegesis. And there's something in the evangelical world or the larger Christian world, which is much more fundamentalist and which tries to read the Bible far more literally. And has that somehow influenced our own traditions? And if so, negatively?
I would take issue, Jeff, with the framing of the
question. I'm sorry. Let me just clarify that. I don't mean within the halls of academic study or within the halls of conventional Talmud Torah, but in the kind of popular imagination, a kind of literalism that has crept into our engagement with Tanakh study.
So, as I was going to say, I would frame the issue a little bit differently. It is true that the dominant voice in our tradition of biblical interpretation is a midrashic one or a kabbalistic one, and not the attention to pshuto shel mikra. That's true, but this is not because of a rejection of the simple meaning of the text. It is because Chazal always understood that the main point in talking about the Torah, by the Torah I mean the text itself of the Torah, is to engage in exhortation, is to engage in inculcating ideas. And therefore, the world of the text can be greatly expanded. Okay? And that's what they do in Midrash. Okay? Mm-hmm. One might say that's what Divrei Hayamim does to Sefer Melachim. It takes a bunch of stories in Sefer Melachim and in many, many cases, expands them, contracts them, changes them wholesale for the purpose of giving new ideas and lessons that were important for a Second Temple period audience, which is when Divrei Hayamim was written. Mm-hmm. So I don't see this as a rejection of the importance of Pshuto Shel Mikra, but rather simply a recognition that in order to teach Am Yisrael, we have this great reservoir called the text, and therefore we should take the text wherever we can take it to. And I think that alongside that, of course, there's a great tradition of Pshuto Shel Mikra. And I think that for the modern mind, in many cases, this type of attention to Pshuto Shel Mikra is exactly what people are looking for. Mm-hmm. So when we engage in this, or when I try to engage in this kind of half academic work or academic presentation for a lay audience, it isn't chas v'chalila, God forbid, to the denigration of midrashic readings. It's precisely to those that are, let's call them a little more Maimonidean, let's call them a little more literalist, rational, to show them that they can still engage the base text with those proclivities and find a place well within tradition, and it does not put them at odds with intellectual truth.
Before we wrap up, I want to touch on one more topic, and that's the kind of educational agenda that you've undertaken, and that's implicit in the book. Anyone looking for the kind of handyman's guide to solving all crises of faith is not going to find it in this book. There are no secret codes. You don't purport to have the knockout punch that proves the divinity of authorship. And anybody
well,
that would
maybe half a knockout. You know, I have one chapter where for me, I come away saying, "Wow, this must be a divine text," but I'll leave that for readers.
Okay, but I didn't mean that by way of critique. On the quite the contrary, I mean it as praise. But somebody who's looking for the 10 easy answers to the most challenging question of faith, well, there are no 10 easy answers. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there is, I think, a serious educational teachers, educators, rabbis, parents will find a wealth of material in the book, which will serve them well in dealing with the challenges that are presented by these by this set of topics of belief and faith and biblical criticism. And in the process of working on the book over many years, and then, you know, even more recently, once the book has kind of come out and begun to make ripples, you've told me that you've come to understand some of the educational challenges differently and how they play out today versus how they did years ago, and particularly how they play out differently for young men and for young women. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. First, let me just say that there's an enormous generation gap here. I look at the people who are reading this book because I get emails and I see posts on Facebook and all, and you can see just by year, it's so clear. There's very few people over 50, not so many people over 40. A bunch of people in their 30s and 20s are reading this book. And this is so important for us as parents, you know, who are maybe raising teenagers. And we, you know, it's so easy to fall into the feeling of, you know, wow, I was threatened by this stuff. And I never thought that I had to think about it. So maybe I'll just hide it from my child, or maybe hope and pretend that they won't be exposed to it. And that's the wrong way to go. We got to understand, folks, that our kids are getting exposed to this, especially English speaking children, much more so I find than Hebrew speaking children, because the internet is in English. And just so much out there. And, you know, therefore, even if this wasn't your issue when you were growing up, and maybe it doesn't even bother you at all today, but your children are going to get exposed to it. And therefore, we have to have not only resources like this book and another book that I would mention, the Koran Land of Israel Tanakh volume on Exodus has an amazing wealth of resources for how to engage wonderful findings of archaeology and demonstrate what they contribute to our Talmud Torah. So the main point, this first main point that I would want to make is that with regard to our children and the children that are coming after them, we must insist that this is somehow addressed, maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, already in high school. You got to be in it to win it. That was the line of the New York State Lottery when I was growing up, and it's true here too. If we just don't talk about it, don't think that they're not going to know about it. All they're going to know is that our rebbes were just too afraid to deal with it, and therefore they must have nothing to say. So that's lesson number one. Number two, as to your question, Jeff, about gender. So what I've noticed is something. This has really been a really recent discovery, I would say, for me, because for years, I would get emails with people, because I've been putting out essays for a while. I would get emails from people, and it was always from men. And when I would go on Facebook and I would look at the threads that were discussing anything really related to biblical criticism, I would see that it was men who were there. And when you see posts about these issues and you look at the likes, men. And when I would go abroad and, you know, do scholar in residence and see the people who would crowd around afterwards and ask questions, men. And I began to think, what? Without judging, just I want to understand what is it here. And what I've discovered, wrote a little bit about this, got some very, very helpful feedback, especially from women educators and women who had studied these materials deeply, is the following. That just because they don't make a lot of noise doesn't mean that they're not bothered by it. Maybe not in the same numbers, I don't know, but there is a difference in the way in sometimes in which men and women process theological issues, and just when the types of structures that are important to allow them to feel comfortable to express themselves. Mm-hmm. So for example, Facebook. I mean, some of these Facebook threads, you know, about, you know, the historicity of this or that, or J, P, E, and D. I mean, those posts are just oozing with testosterone. You know, the combative and aggressive nature of these discussions are just the type of thing that a woman say, I'm checking out, I'm just not participating in this. You know, or if there's a large discussion, let's say in a co-ed environment, co-ed, it could be in school, it could be in a public talk, and the guys are, you know, the men are going at it. Sometimes the women will just don't feel comfortable expressing themselves there. I've had women educators who have said to me, who have spoken with younger women students, younger female students, who say, you know, these issues, because they're so central to our belief, areas of religious fervor and belief are a space of intimacy for a woman, and therefore she will just naturally gravitate to talking with another woman, as opposed to even someone who might have a certain standing or a certain expertise in these issues who happens to be a male. Another woman has suggested to me that sometimes there is a deficit of self-confidence that some of our women feel. Oh, if I'm asking these questions, which seem to suggest that I'm not committed, well, maybe I just don't know enough. I'm afraid how I might be perceived. If I express this out loud, like on Facebook, will it perhaps even influence my possibilities of dating who I date? I mean, these are things that I've been told. So the main takeaway here is that especially when we as men are addressing audiences, whether in our writing or in our podcasts or in person, there's likely to be some silence from the other side of the mechitza, and we have to know what that means. It doesn't mean disinterest. It doesn't mean there's no issues there. It means there's an importance of here for redundancy, that is that there are men who are speaking about this in our community and that there are women who are speaking about this in our community. So that if it's known that there are women who have thought deeply about these issues and are prepared to work with others like themselves, that our younger women will feel that they have an address and someone to whom they can turn.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the main takeaway might be the idea that we can no longer delude ourselves into thinking that just because a student is not asking these questions, it doesn't mean that they don't have the questions, and it doesn't mean that they haven't encountered these issues. And the book does a great service in providing a resource to, as I said, parents, educators, rabbis, anyone who is tasked with educating mm-hmm. young people and creating an atmosphere in our community where we can talk about these things. We can do so confidently. If we don't have all of the answers, we certainly can show that we are engaged with the challenges. And ultimately, there's nothing to be afraid of. Ultimately, belief is something that, well, that lives in the heart. And your work, I think, has done a lot to create space for belief to be bolstered. And that's a great service. The book is Ani Ma'amin, Biblical Criticism, Historical Truth, and the 13 Principles of Faith from Magid Books. Our reviewer, Rabbi Chaim Angel, in our upcoming issue, says that it expands our horizons in learning, methodology, and religious growth. And that, I think, is something you can take and blurb on the paperback edition. Thank you, Rabbi Professor Josh Berman. We look forward to reading more of your work and continuing conversations about these and other topics. We thank our readers and listeners. Please visit the website of traditiononline.org to access the excerpted chapter and sample all of the items from our recent and upcoming issue. In the meantime, till our next episode, we wish everyone continued good health.